That's a very, very beautiful open swimmer there from their release Canyon and the track Bark. And you can catch them playing at the Northcote Social Club this Friday, the 17th of October, launching Canyon. It is 12 minutes past 11. I am joined by journalist, author, Guardian columnist, filmmaker, blogger, Anthony Lowenstein. Thanks for being there today, Anthony.
Thanks, Michelle. How are you guys?
I'm really good. Now, there's so much news since we last spoke, I think, and today we're going to talk about the conflict in Iraq and potentially Syria. Yeah. But I wanted to start with the definition of war. It seems politicians will do anything to skirt around that word. Why is that, Anthony?
Well, I guess it depends which politicians we're talking about. There are certainly some who are pretty eager to get involved in war, I'd say in the US, even in parts of Europe, and some in Australia. But I think in Australia, the mainstream politicians, mostly Labor and Liberal, are scared, I think, in some ways of labelling what we're doing as a war, because they know, and this is according to many public opinion polls for years, that the conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan post 9/11 were complete disasters, and the public is pretty worried, sceptical, fearful of a re-engagement in a way that, in blunt terms, takes Australian lives. And I think the fear is that Tony Abbott or Bill Shorten don't want to use appropriate language, and sadly too much of the press is happy to go along with that, because they know that the Australian public is worried that if there are so-called boots on the ground, and I fear that's where it's going to go, almost inevitably, either with Australian forces or other countries' forces, that there'll be casualties. This is what happens in war. And in another, again, in a very blunt terms, it's bad for the government's PR that they worry that the Australian public might not be that happy about it, frankly, and I don't blame them. And I think a lot of Australians, according to a recent Essential poll last week, on one hand were supportive of strikes against ISIS in Iraq, and yet they also believed that by doing so, we massively increase the risk of terrorism here at home. So Australian public opinion is, as usual on these issues, very conflicted. And I think that's partly because most of the press, with some notable exceptions, tells a pretty bloody awful story about what we're actually doing over there and don't give much honesty to the people.
Do you think that then that the media does allow the government to sort of skirt around these issues to the detriment of what we actually know, the honest truth about things?
Absolutely they do. I mean, this has been documented for years, and Australia is not unique in this, sadly. But one of the really tragic parts of this is the media allows hysteria to be created. It's not a question that simply Tony Abbott or Bill Shorten comes out and says ISIS is a threat or there's a homegrown terrorist threat. The only reason that message is amplified massively is through the press. I mean, the press, you know, Tony Abbott can speak as much as he wants. If he speaks to an empty room, then his message goes nowhere. The press has been directly complicit, in my view, in contributing to the atmosphere in Australia of fear. And I'm not saying for a second that there's not a threat. I think regardless of what Australia does or did in the Middle East, there is a threat. There is a tiny minority of extremists in Australia who want to do the public harm. I think that's a pretty uncontroversial thing to say. The question is what you do about that and how you manage that. And even in the last month or so, since there's been, as any listener will know, huge terror raids across Australia, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne, the way the media reported that was unbelievable. It was almost as if it was the D-Day landing in the Second World War, that the Sydney Morning Herald, not just the Murdoch press, was sort of used to being massively critical of how the Murdoch press reports these issues, and we should be. But the truth of the matter is that often, in my view, the Fairfax press, often, in fact, even the ABC, has been pretty appalling in how they've covered this, because the majority of people in the press have little or no experience in the Muslim community, very few contacts in that community, and are far too willing and happy to accept intelligence services or government spin as the truth. And too often we've seen over the years, post 9/11 and certainly before, an environment where those so-called threats are exaggerated. There is a threat, but it's massively exaggerated, and the press plays a huge role in creating an atmosphere within the public that says we are scared. And if the average person turns on the TV or watches or listens to the radio or however they consume their news in the last month or two, with a few notable exceptions, the vast bulk of the press has basically been saying, repeating ad nauseum what Tony Abbott and Bill Shorten is saying, we're under attack. Not in terms of conventional war, I mean, but under attack. Apparently, ISIS has declared war on the world, so we're told. Yes, the media, to me, has a huge role to play, and they've resolutely, massively failed. And
do you think that they will start? We have seen, you know, some of the reporting around those terror raids, which was just woefully incompetent, and had, you know, pictures of a sword. Next thing you know, there's all this speculation about what that sword was going to be used for.
Yeah.
Sheepishly, it comes out about a week and a half later that, well, that sword is actually a plastic sword that you can buy in many religious shops. That news gets buried, you know, four or five or six or seven, or never even gets into the paper. How do you think that the journalists that are reporting that sort of stuff will stop and think next time?
No. Absolutely I don't, no. Because the truth of the matter is, we've seen this time and time and time again. I think we need to understand the culture within much of the mainstream press. And it is one based on, it's a pack mentality. And we see this on so many issues, not just in terrorism. The problem is that when it comes to issues like terrorism, there's very few voices or positions that don't require an anonymous source to give you information. So a terror raid happens, just coincidentally or not, some of the TV crews happen to be there, or they're given footage immediately of seeing, you know, hundreds and hundreds of cops descending on a couple of homes. I mean, the idea that you'd need 800 police to arrest literally a handful of people, which is what happened in Sydney a month ago, is absurd, regardless of who these people may be. And again, we don't know, are they a serious threat? Maybe they are, maybe they're not. But it's an absurdity to think that you need such huge firepower.
And it also it almost doesn't matter whether they are or not, because it's been splashed across the front pages
Absolutely.
Of the newspaper. Everyone's come to this assumption, and then it's almost too late.
It is too late, and of course that's exactly the point, which is exactly what the government is happy to have happen. That's exactly what the police and intelligence services want to happen. And the reason I think the press, and again, I'm generalising and there are exceptions to this, and I think The Guardian, although I write for them, I think they've done a pretty good job on these issues. A lot of the other press, Fairfax Press often, a lot of ABC and the Murdoch Press, it's far too easy, I think, for those of us on the left to simply damn the Murdoch Press here. This issue is far worse, in fact, than just the Murdoch Press. The Fairfax Press has been equally hysterical. I mean, after those massive terror raids in Sydney, the headline of the Sydney Morning Herald was, Australia under attack, or Sydney under attack. I mean, that was the headline. Now, all you need to really read is that headline, and you're going to feel pretty scared if you don't have a wider context, understanding, etc. And I think that's happening again because journalists, in the large part, are on the drip feed. When it comes to issues like this, they have very few of any independent positions to offer. They rarely, if ever, speak to, shall we say, dissenting intelligence views or dissenting positions that actually question some of the policies. I mean, this is one short example. So last night on Q&A, some listeners may have watched on ABC TV Q&A, and there were five politicians and Catherine McGregor, who's a, people may remember her, she was used to be a man and has had surgery to be a woman, transgender figure who works very high up in the military. And the reason I mention her, not because of her sexuality or gender, but just in terms of listeners may know who she is, she was talking eloquently about the war against ISIS. However, she's eloquent, but what she's saying is absolute warmongering bollocks. And she's allowed to say that last night on Q&A for literally minutes and minutes and minutes, saying that, yes, every single strike Australia has is a precision. We never target civilians. The American government has never targeted civilians. She says it with such seriousness that the other panelists and Tony Jones, the host, feel obliged to let her speak uncritically. The truth of the matter is what she's saying is an absolute lie, certainly in relation to the US military, not just in the current conflict, but certainly in conflicts in the past. I mean, just last week, there were numerous reports from within Syria of US missiles killing countless civilians, which is one of the reasons why this so-called magical Syrian opposition that America says we're going to be supporting is so pissed off, because America is killing their own people. I mean, this is the absurdity of the current war. So the environment that we're under here in the press is on a so-called serious show like Q&A, and you have supposedly serious people talking about the war, they're allowed to spout crap because there's actually very few people who know what's going on. And actually, I mean, even last night, again, you had the vast majority of speakers, whether it's politicians or even Greg Sheridan, our good friend from the Australian, or others, who are talking about a war, and the information they're getting is like they're describing a press release from the Australian military. And it's a problem. Like, and therefore, the Australian public might think, oh, you know, we're talking seriously about a war here, and yes, Australia always cares about civilians and never targets civilians, and they would never do that, and our boys and our girls in, you know, uniform are noble people. I'm not suggesting everyone in the military are war criminals. I'm not saying that for a second. What I'm saying is that the Australian government, and this has been shown because the US government, does not know what it's doing over there.
And it has become commonplace in this country, as it is in America, to even question what's happening in military, you know, language in the military world. You are seen to be therefore supportive of, you know,
of the enemy.
Of the enemy.
Absolutely. And that kind of reflexive sort of faux patriotism is kind of a farce.
But, and I found that talk about, you know, we never target civilians and so on
last night.
I find that kind of talk just absolutely bizarre, that that can be talked about in this rational sort of way when, hang on, you strip that back, that's, of course, that would be absolutely illegal to do that. We shouldn't be sort of patting ourselves on the back that we don't do that. That is an illegal thing to do.
Well, it's illegal, and if nothing else, there's just such massive, overwhelming evidence that it simply is not true. I mean, putting aside the claim about Australian missiles in the last week or so, I mean, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Libya, I mean, there are so many examples and so many cases, many of which I might add are before the US courts now, where the US military killing countless civilians. Let's think about the countless people killed from US drones, many of whom are civilians, Pakistan, Yemen, Somalia, Afghanistan. I mean, this idea somehow that America doesn't target civilians and therefore we're noble. And of course, the reason it's framed like that is very obvious. We're noble, we're good, they're crazy, they're terrorists, they're awful. And I'm not for a second saying ISIS are lovely. ISIS clearly, or many of people in ISIS, are bloodthirsty fundamentalists. There's really, to me, no question about that. And how you do deal with that, how the West or anyone deals with that, is a legitimate question to ask. But if you frame yourself as noble and them as savages, anyone who spends any time in the Middle East out of the green zone actually speaks to normal, rational human beings, what they'll say is, frankly, that many in the Arab world have seen the actual results of what so-called precision bombing has caused. And in all these countries, you have countless civilians who've either been killed, families have had members killed or abducted or kidnapped by the US or forces working with the US. And there's very few journalists I can think of in the last sort of few months who have spoken rationally about this. I'd urge listeners, if they don't know, to read. There's an amazing British journalist called Patrick Coburn, C-O-C-K-B-U-R-N. He writes for The Independent. He's been visiting Syria and Iraq for many, many years, including in the last 6 months, and he's written extensively about ISIS. He has amazing contacts. He's one of the best writers in the Western world anyway, writing about these issues. And the reason he's so important, not because he's critical and sceptical, because what he's saying is that on the ground, where it matters, either the civilians being killed or other kind of areas, it's really important that we recognise what America's apparent plan is that Australia is blindly following. We're apparently going to be working with an Iraqi government. So we heard again this morning and last night on Q&A. We're apparently going to be supporting a so-called moderate Syrian opposition. And what Coburn is very clearly explaining is that in Iraq, for example, you have an Iraqi government that spent the last years, US and Iranian-backed government, I might add, funding, arming, training Shia death squads. That's exactly what they are, killing Sunni civilians and critics. That's who we're working with. And Coburn, just literally 2 days ago, was writing about this, saying in many cities around Iraq now that remain under the control of Baghdad's government, you have Shia death squads. These are the people that we're partnering with who are killing Sunnis in huge numbers. And that, therefore, it's not unlikely that many of those Sunnis, in fact, will feel far more allegiance to ISIS than a central Baghdad government. I mean, this is the kind of incredibly grim reality that exists over there. And yet we don't hear that here. We sort of hear about, yes, Abbott said, yes, Iraq has invited us in. Well, Iraq is not an independent government, for one. Secondly, this is what the government actually stands for, which is sheer brutality. And we wonder why this war, and I fear this inevitably, and you see this happening in the last while, we're being softened up to support the introduction of ground troops, because we keep on being told by these wonderful military experts who keep on popping up every night on 7:30 and late line that, yes, the air war is not going to succeed here, we have to put troops on the ground. Okay, well, troops on the ground is going to only contribute to a complete disaster, because yet again America's going to be caught up in a guerrilla war, which yet again they're going to lose because they have learned nothing from the Vietnam War 40 years ago. I mean, history keeps on repeating, Michelle, and it's really, really sad to see.
I mean, history keeps on repeating, but I guess there is a massive frustration from many here, including yourself, in that there is this glossing over of what this has to do with the invasion in 2003. Absolutely. Also that we've never had a full inquiry into that invasion and how that should inform what we do in these sort of situations now.
Yes, no, yes, absolutely, that's true. So, I mean, 2003 doesn't get talked about very much. I mean, when it does get talked about, it's almost like, yes, it has nothing to do with what's happening now. Well, it has everything to do with it. In fact, to the point where many of the key leadership in ISIS, including the leader himself and indeed many other former Baathists, and this I think easily goes to the myth of what ISIS is. ISIS is not simply a fundamentalist group. Clearly there are fundamentalist elements, and this is not a second to defend their actions, but many of the key leadership in ISIS, in fact, are former key loyalists to Saddam. And for them, this is payback. This is payback for what they see in their view, in their world, was legitimate war in 2003, was the overthrow of Saddam, and many of the key lieutenants who were not captured by the US after the war went underground for many, many years and have now become key military planners with ISIS, who know Iraq clearly very, very well, which is why they're able to take over vast swathes of the country so fast. And you're right. I mean, putting aside the military aspect, there's also the catastrophic civilian toll, which we never really hear about. I mean, no one knows exactly how many civilians were killed in Iraq. It's anywhere probably between 500,000 and 1 million, maybe more. I mean, this is, and they weren't all by the US, but a lot of them were by forces unleashed by the war.
And the fact that we don't know that is really quite staggering, isn't it?
Absolutely. And we don't know how many people we've killed in Afghanistan either, because everyone just moves on, right? Everyone just moves on. And now there's a new war. And the problem is, and I often say to my editors at The Guardian, I feel like I've been writing the same column, Michelle, for the last 12 years, like every 2 weeks, is that the same military so-called experts are paraded on the press week after week after week. So a new war happens, the media has the same people on their Rolodex and they call them up. So it's whether it's Jim Molan or David Kilcullen, mostly men who your listeners will most certainly have seen if they don't recognise the names. And these are people who have fundamentally failed when they've actually been in these wars. I mean, David Kilcullen is one short example. Worked with David Petraeus in Iraq in the so-called surge. He's heralded in our press. He's on 7:30 and late line seemingly every second day as one of the world's great counterterrorism experts. Really? Right. So he was a key advisor to Petraeus in Iraq and Afghanistan in the Middle East. How have those countries worked out? He now runs a consultancy for profit to go around the world offering wonderful, insightful advice for money about how to manage these kind of issues. This is the kind of person who routinely appears in our press as a so-called expert, and he's a complete failure. And this, to me, is really the media's fault, that they are so unimaginative about who they go to, that they're desperate for some kind of so-called insightful person. Wouldn't it be a crazy idea, to get someone who's not an official figure, like an Iraqi civilian who might speak English or through translation, or an Afghan or a Syrian? You know what? It's not that hard to find someone who would be able to speak clearly about what's going on. It may not be, some may be, you know, critical of what the US is doing, and some might not be, but the idea that somehow you have to have predominantly white, Western, male, military, non-experts, claiming to be experts, in our press is just so representative of how broken our media is when it comes to reporting war.
I think it's our power structures completely. And you talk about this in your book, Prophets of Doom, and the same column that you've been writing for the last 12 years. But this is an industry. These people benefit from being able to keep these conflicts continuing.
There's definitely that aspect. And in fact, one of the things that I wrote about in my column last week was that when the war and Obama announced this new war on ISIS in September, share prices of all the key military companies went through the roof. Now, I'm not suggesting that there was some grand conspiracy between them. I don't suggest that for a second. But the truth of the matter is that the lobbying that those companies have been doing for years, whether it's Lockheed Martin, Raytheon or others, hugely helps their bottom line. You have, and as the New York Times and, in fact, The Nation did a wonderful piece about a month ago, which I urge listeners to read online, while many of the military experts who appear on American TV talking about how we have to deepen the war against ISIS, many of them, it's not acknowledged, are also on the payroll of military companies making money from these wars. It's such a central point, right? And yet the NBC or CBS or ABC in the US just happens to conveniently forget to mention that these individuals are also making money when they're commenting about the war. So they're benefiting for a war continuing, for a war deepening, for troops on the ground, whatever it may be. That's the kind of, to me, real hypocrisy. And again, in Australia, when it comes to issues around the people we have on in our press, I think that journalists need to ask pretty serious questions about David Kilcullen. And I'm going to be careful how I choose my words here, but he's someone who runs a consultancy in difficult countries. And I think it's a legitimate question to ask, is his company making money from any of these conflicts? Are they trying to get business in any of these countries? Are they advising any individuals, countries, companies in these kind of nations where someone like him advocates greater engagement militarily? They're to me legitimate questions that, as far as I know, and I've tried to ask these questions myself without much success over the years, but I think it's a legitimate question to ask these individuals who are paraded as experts. Are they actually making money from it? And frankly, often they are.
You're working on a new book about disaster capitalism, which follows on from Prophets of Doom. What do you think we're likely to see out of this conflict? And you hinted at it there, but we're likely to see a whole raft of things in this area, from infrastructure build, from weapons and everything, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, infrastructure seems, Michelle, such a long way away. I mean, the idea of, I guess the main difference between the previous wars and this one, certainly at the moment anyway, no one's talking about nation building. You know, we're not hearing the sort of lofty, clearly bullshit rhetoric that we heard in 2003 of Bush talking about going into Iraq and building a glorious Western-style democracy. We don't hear that sort of stuff anymore because it never worked and it was never going to, but no one's talking about that now, really. What you are going to see, though, and what you're already seeing, in fact, I just saw overnight, Eric Prince, who was the founder of Blackwater, listeners will remember that's one of the largest military contracting groups, says, if America wants to put boots on the ground in Iraq or Syria and they don't want to use US troops, use contractors. And that's exactly what's happening already now. I know it's happening now. It's going to increase. And the reason that the US and other countries use contractors in very difficult places is they can do things legally without any real concern of a problem. And I say that because in Iraq and other countries as well, they're given immunity. There is massive US pressure on the Iraqi government, it has been for years, to to allow a contractor, if, and it's a big if, they do something wrong, allegedly they do something wrong, they're not going to face justice in the Iraqi legal system. I mean, it's an absurd situation, right? So definitely contractors are going to make huge amounts of money. There is obviously also a likelihood, very strong likelihood now, I fear, of much larger military involvement, whether it's boots on the ground or some other kind of engagement. I think it's also important listeners just are aware that whenever we hear our leaders say there are no boots on the ground, that's an expression which I hate using in a work, it's military jargon, but it's actually bollocks. We have had, and America has, special advisors, so-called, working with the Iraqi government and others for months. The Americans have had them there in Syria and elsewhere for months. These are Western personnel on the ground. They might not be officially army, but they're special operations. They are intelligence, et cetera, CIA. That's boots on the ground. Often Obama doesn't want to mention that, but that's a pretty important point, you know?
Some polls are saying that there is, a slim majority of support for the action that the government is taking. Do you think that that changes when, you know, we do see boots on the ground, so to speak?
Yes, and the reason that often changes, as I said before, was that if there starts being Western casualties, I mean, this is... I mean, let's face it, you know, the only reason, this is a bit of a segue, but certainly it's a relevant point. Everyone knows that the reason Ebola is so out of control in West Africa, it's only black people dying. Who cares? And yeah, let's be blunt about it. If it was white people, massive numbers of white people dying from Ebola, I can guarantee there'd be a hugely different Western response. This is the same when it comes to war in the Middle East, or Iraq or Syria or elsewhere. But ultimately, if there are lots of Iraqis or Syrians being killed, who cares? There's so many of them anyway, right? No one cares. And this is the thinking. If there are Western troops who are being killed or kidnapped, then that certainly would change. And I think also what might change the equation, and this, of course, requires decent media to do its job, is to actually explain who we're fighting with and who we're fighting for over there. I mean, this idea we heard again last night on Q&A, there's a huge Arab contingency fighting alongside us. Yes, we're really proud to be siding with Saudi Arabia and Bahrain. I mean, yeah, this was said last night by that military woman, Catherine McGregor, with pride. Isn't it wonderful? Is it? A country like Saudi Arabia that beheads its own citizens, no one seems to care about that. You know, those beheadings, I might add. ISIS beheadings, that's awful, let's go to war with them. No one's threatening to go to war with Saudi Arabia. I'm not saying we should, by the way, but this idea somehow that we're so selective in our outrage about these issues. I mean, Saudi Arabia is one of the most brutal regimes in the world. It runs an appallingly repressive state, gender apartheid. It's not even a one-party state. It's run, you know, by a corrupt royal family. The idea somehow that we're partnering up with countries like that to apparently fight a greater threat that is ISIS. I would say that if America is deadly serious, which it never is, and Australia is deadly serious about fighting terrorism, there is one country particularly above arguably many others that you would massively tackle, and I'm not talking about militarily, it's Saudi Arabia. Key source, 15 of the 19 hijackers on 9/11 came from Saudi Arabia. Massive amounts of funding for various insurgencies around the world. The spread of Wahhabism, an absolutely appalling ideology, comes from Saudi Arabia. Initial funding for ISIS comes from elements within the Bahraini, Qatari and Saudi royal families. These are our allies. These are our friends. And yet we go around the world talking about we're going to be fighting terrorism. No. We're not fighting terrorism. Unfortunately, we're creating it. And that's, I wish more people in the press would actually say that, because it's the truth.
We have been speaking with Anthony Lowenstein, the brilliant author, journalist, Guardian columnist, blogger, filmmaker. You are working on your new book about disaster capitalism. And in the meantime, you'll be writing the very columns that you've been writing for quite a while on this.
Indeed.
I think, Anthony, it really will just sort of continue on and on, will you, even though there is a glut of information of what we should and shouldn't be doing in these sorts of situations?
Well, sadly, I fear that's right. It's really hard to see at the moment how this situation with ISIS is not going to massively escalate. As I said, because the air war is failing miserably already, despite what bollocks we were hearing last night on Q&A. The air war is not working to unseat ISIS because it's becoming a guerrilla war. So ISIS, like it's happening in conflicts past, meld into local communities, and therefore you can't just sort of bomb indiscriminately unless you want to be, the Western allies during the Second World War. So, yeah, this is going to go on for a long time, and the concern is that there are too few journalists and who are critical about this. And one of the things that I've often said is that the issue is not just, we often hear this term embedded. I mean, embedded on one hand means a journalist is embedded with the US Army or Australian military. Embedding is not just a physical thing, it's a psychological state that you feel somehow you need to repeat uncritically or certainly be less sceptical about government or military claims.
What's about being an insider?
That's true. I mean, as I've often said, the worst show on television, and Jesus, good competition, let me tell you, Insiders is the most revealing and offensive show on television. Yes, they haven't invited me on. I'm not expecting to be invited on anytime soon, which I'm surely upset about. It really goes to the heart, doesn't it, of what is wrong with the press. And America's got shows like Meet the Press and others, so there's equivalent shows in the US. It's almost like four journalists crapping on about how little they know about the world because they haven't really gone anywhere. They essentially spend their time in Canberra, maybe Melbourne, maybe elsewhere, Sydney, don't really speak to anyone beyond their bubble, rarely leave their office unless they go on a trip with Abbott or Shorten. That's their world. And their insights are, yes, some are kind of normally on the soft left, some are on the soft right. That's the kind of degree of so-called debate when Gerard Henderson and David Marr disagree. And that's sort of fun to watch for 5 minutes. But it's symptomatic of the problem with those kind of programs that the average citizen would say, why would journalists be proud to be insiders? And that, to me, just goes against what the media should be. But that's sadly, Michelle, a minority view in the mainstream press.
So we shouldn't start a lobbying campaign to get Anthony Lowenstein on Insiders?
I mean, if they invite me on for the record, I would go on. Yeah, I'd go on and try to cause trouble. Of course I would. But, I'm not expecting a call anytime soon. No.
Well, it has been a pleasure giving you a platform here at Triple R, of course. We have been speaking with Anthony Lowenstein. All of his writing, and in fact probably this interview a little bit later on, will be up on anthonylowenstein.com. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thanks so
Anthony.
Much, Michelle. It was great to chat.
We'll speak to you soon. You are tuned to Triple R.